Global Capital Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Global Capital Podcast. I'm Ralph Sinclair and I'm the Frequent Issuers Managing Editor.
And I'm Mike Turner, the Corporate Bonds Editor.
Now, later in this week's edition, we'll be taking you to the extreme corners of Europe. We'll be visiting both Turkey and, even more glamorously, Birmingham. We'll be talking to John Hay, who's usually my co-host, but is off doing other duties this week, about another crisis in UK local authority financing. And then we'll be talking to George Collard, our senior emerging markets reporter, about two Turkish borrowers that did deals this week and what might lie in store for the sovereign. But first, Mike, we're going to be talking about a story you've written, which I thought was very interesting. You're hearing about a great migration underway in the in corporate financing, and that's the herds of European companies that are at this very moment sweeping majestically across the plain from the loan market to the bond markets. Why are companies changing their source of financing like so drastically all of a sudden?
Well, that's quite the image, thinking of corporates being majestic herds. I don't know if I put that to many treasurers that I know. Only joking, treasurers, you're majestic. First of all, I think it's important to state up front that due to the private nature of the loan market and the sort of private placement bond markets, a lot of this is anecdotal because you just don't have the same sort of data out there that you do in the public bond markets. But you know, the anecdotes come from people who are at the coalface of these markets, so you know they should know. And what I am hearing is that lending is tightening up for some parts of the corporate bond market, and this is encouraging borrowers who are maybe struggling to get loans or who can get loans, but it's not as attractive as it once was, to start looking at new markets such as public bonds and US private placements.
Okay. Now, the thing is, though, Europe's not short of a bank or two. So how can loans be getting that much tougher for corporate borrowers? Now, obviously, interest rates have gone up, but that means higher rates in the bond market too. And meanwhile, we know that loans are often done cheaply by banks for their clients so that they can develop their relationship. So what's going on?
Yeah, loans is a sort of permanently loss-making product for banks. And when money was incredibly cheap for banks to get, then that kind of made it, you know, perfectly fine. It's okay to do that because you could make it up elsewhere quite easily. But now that it's much more expensive to cover your cost of loans, banks are having to put the cost of loans up, right? And that means that, particularly for the sort of lower rung borrowers that would come across to the bank market and typically wouldn't necessarily go to the bond markets. And it's a mix of, there's no one thing, it's a mix of loans becoming a bit more expensive, some banks changing their lending criteria and sort of reducing their risk appetite towards different sectors or different credit ratings, for example. And what this means is that if you're, you know, if you're one of the biggest borrowers in Europe, if you're like an E.ON, for example, then you have no problem at all. You still have exactly the same access as you've always had, and everything's hunky-dory because banks are desperate to keep your business. But if you are a smaller company, you know, suddenly what might have been an easy shoe-in for six banks to lend to you, now suddenly there's only three banks who are willing to do this sort of business, so the price goes up a bit and it becomes a bit more tricky, and you know, you might have to accept more stringent terms or a shorter maturity, or it might become more expensive to draw the loan down, for example. And these things are, you know, once you hear these things, suddenly it's not the slam dunk it was. Although given that the Rugby World Cup has just started, maybe it's not the try that it was. And you have to, you know, you can start considering other markets to raise your money, and other markets start looking attractive comparatively.
I mean, it's not just about the margin that a borrower has to pay on its loan, is it? Because I guess banks as well will start demanding more, you know, in terms of what is known as ancillary business, i.e. the stuff that makes the money for the bank once it has provided the loan. Those are things like bond mandates or advisory work or derivatives provision. Are banks making more demands on their corporate clients for that kind of work to justify the loan.
Yeah, that's what I'm hearing, which banks have always sort of made this level of demand. And when I've spoken to, you know, the way this works changes with each corporate treasurer. I've spoken to corporate treasurers who say, yeah, we keep, like, you know, dedicated lists. We know our lenders. We know exactly how much ancillary we've given them so we can, you know, work out that matrix and make it work and everyone's happy. And then you have others who say, well, yeah, we have our lending group, but when we come to do a bond, you know, we're going to pick the best banks for it every time and not worry about, oh, we owe this bank X, or, you know, for whatever reason. If they've lent to us, they've lent to us, and that's that. So yeah, there's a lot of difference in the way it's approached, but the impression I'm getting at the moment is that there's more pressure for banks to be able to justify lending below cost with, you know, things like ancillary business, particularly as fees for bonds have not risen with the cost of everything else. You know, it's not like they're marked to inflation or anything. So banks aren't getting the money back on bond mandates that they were getting in the heydays. So there's much more pressure all round to make more money for banks, and loans is one of the things that doesn't make money.
Are the companies going to the bond market? Are they more like refugees seeking shelter, or are they, you know, to make the comparisons often made in the mainstream UK press, more like economic migrants? I mean, are they going to get a benefit from going to the bond market that they don't get in their more traditional habitat of the loan market?
Well, I mean, I think so, for sure. I'm an advocate of the bond market, given my job, but the bond market offers, you know, longevity that you don't get in the loan market. You don't get the sort of maturity past a solid 5 years. You get sort of 5+1+1s, which are sort of add-on years that you can ignite clauses so that you can add maturity to your loans. But on the whole, you know, so that's what, 7 years? Whereas in the bond market, 10 years is not unheard of at all. And if you're going to sterling, you know, Motability went to 25 years this week. So, you know, there's a sort of maturity there that you just can't get in the bank market. And then at the same time, you are also, you know, it's a plus and a con, but you are, rather than having to appease sort of a handful of banks and get them to lend to you at terms that you like, you're out in the open market and you're, you know, dealing with 100 investors, and the way that market influences come and affect you. And we'll speak to George later about how, you know, change in the market environment affected deals one day to the other, but that can work positively and negatively. So it can, you know, that can be a good thing. If the market is in a rising place and there's lots of demand for debt, lots of demand for your type of debt, then, you know, great, you can get a deal better than maybe you would have thought you could.
I guess that's uncertainty, though, which traders thrive on, but treasurers and the like generally hate. They like things to be steady, certain and secure, don't they?
Yeah, of course they do. But, you know, they're out of luck for that for the moment.
Indeed. Now, how have debut bond issuers been doing of late? Are there signs of encouragement for the migrating masses?
So we've had some really quite sort of spectacular debuts this week. And just to be clear as well, before I start, this isn't to imply that these companies had any issue with the loan market at all, but nonetheless, that, you know, they are debuts. And we had you'll have to forgive me for my pronunciation, I am from Essex and not from Germany, but Rewe, the German supermarket chain, made its debut in the bond market with a really well received 900 million 2030 debut deal. So that's a 7-year deal. That's sort of right up to the limit of where banks typically feel comfortable lending. And even then, as I mentioned, you have to sort of invoke clauses to get to 7 years. But that deal got 3.3 billion euros of demand. And, you know, that's one of the biggest oversubscription ratios this week. So investors obviously, you know, really jumped into that and liked the idea of this debut. So that's encouraging for anyone else looking at the market. Then you also had Asset Abloy, which they haven't been in the market for more than 20 years. And to the point where even some of the lead bankers on the deal, you know, considered it a debut because they didn't have any bonds outstanding, and they haven't been outstanding for long enough that investors kind of forgot about this company and what it means. But they raised 1.8 billion euros in acquisition finance. And, you know, that shows what the Eurobond market can do. It can raise significant sums of money over long maturities and work very, very effectively.
It's not going to work for every corporate, though, is it, that finds itself facing an uncompetitive an uncompetitively priced loan, because every borrower can approach the bond market.
No, that's the issue. To approach the bond market, you need a certain level of critical mass. So you need, you can easily get away sort of 100 million euro loan, and that's, a decent sized loan, and everyone's happy with that. But you can't really do that in the bond market. So you need to be looking for a certain size. However, there are other options. The Schuldschein market, for example, has been very popular since really the end of the coronavirus lockdowns. And the US private placement market has also seen quite a few debut issuers come knocking on investors' doors. And these are good spots to raise less money. It will be more expensive. You have to pay the sort of privacy premium, which basically is the premium that the investors there demand, because they'll buy your bonds and they won't ever be able to sell them, in effect. So they're taking a bet on your company existing in 12 years and being able to service its debt. So there'll be a premium over the public market, but that option is still there. And then by doing that, you diversify your borrowing capabilities away from banks and into something new.
Okay, well, that's encouraging. It's good to know there's a home for everyone in somewhere in the capital markets. And I guess we'll keep track of your coverage, Mike, to see who ends up in the bond market and who ends up with somewhere else, and who falls between the cracks completely.
There will definitely be some that fall through the cracks, without a doubt.
That's what we call news.
So moving from the corporate bond world onto sovereign supranationals and agencies, and things have not been a straight line there, have they, Ralph? What's been going on in that market?
No, I mean, I suppose it's a bit of a development, but plus a change compared to what we spoke about last week. Oftentimes, you would expect the SSA market to go all guns blazing in September. It's usually one of the busiest months of the year for issuance, as it is in, all sorts of different bond markets. And often, deals are very hotly competed for. It's great for issuers and everyone has a marvelous time. This year, it's not really been the case, which is surprising, because the first thing to say is a lot of SSA issuers have got quite far ahead with their funding programs. And there's not that much in relative terms for this market expected over the rest of the year. So you would think there would be plenty of people to pile into bonds. But what we're seeing is a bit of a more of a mixed picture. Now, we're talking here in particular about the market in euros. The market for dollar SSA bonds has gone swimmingly well and is therefore not news and of interest to nobody. So we're going to talk about euros. Now, the week began with two of the biggest and most prestigious issuers in the SSA market bringing euro benchmarks. Those are the EIB, which bought a 3 billion euro five-year deal. It attracted 23 billion euros of orders. So that's whopping, absolutely whopping. And it managed to price the bonds at mid swaps minus 13 basis points. That meant a new issue premium of 2 basis points, all quite standard, or 1 to 2 basis points, depending on who you ask. And it was able to tighten the pricing 2 basis points during execution, which is pretty standard and, sign of a healthy deal. The World Bank was the other issuer that did really well. It brought a 2.5 billion euro 15-year deal that was almost twice subscribed. It managed to tighten pricing on that from mid swaps plus 30 to mid swaps plus 29 basis points. There are other signs of rude health too, like the Development Bank of Japan, for example, did a 500 million euro 12-year deal that was 12 times subscribed. But then on Wednesday, things didn't go quite so well. Now, as we'll hear later from George, the market was a little bit weaker on Wednesday, but nonetheless, there were deals from one German issuer called IBB and another KfW, which is a big German policy bank, that didn't exactly seem to set the world on fire. The one that caught people's attention in particular, though, was from the Council of Europe Development Bank, which priced a billion euros of five-year bonds, and the deal was undersubscribed. They didn't manage to move pricing from mid-swaps minus 7 basis points.
So what does that pricing level on Council of Europe Development Bank's deal imply?
Right. So it's interesting because before the deal was executed, our SSA editor, Addison Gong, spoke to someone who was off the deal, I think, who thought that that level would result in a blowout trade for council, and yet it didn't. So that was a surprise to a lot of people. It's still, the issue is still played a 2 basis point new issue premium, so again, standard for the SSA market, and it came 6 basis points back of that EIB trade, whereas people often perceive 4 basis points to be a fair premium for Council of Europe over EIB.
Okay, so what does all this mean for the market?
So what it means for the market is that no one really has a clue what's going on. There's various competing theories about why investors are not lapping up every bond that's being thrown at them. And therefore, there's a lot of uncertainty about what to do to fix the problem. Now, theories include that investors are already full on SSA names because of the amount of funding that they've done already this year. Someone else suggested, in fact, someone talking about the Council of Europe, in fact, the issuer, suggested that movements in the spread between bonds and swap rates, government bonds and swap rates, so what's known as the swap spread, on Wednesday, in particular, dissuaded some investors from taking part in that deal.
So it was a very specific thing to the day.
Exactly. Specific group of investors affected on the day by a particular move that kept them out of that order book. But, you know, like, I guess who knows, you know, because although that might explain what happened to Council of Europe's order book, it doesn't necessarily explain the other order books and the other sort of lackluster deals we've seen over the last couple of weeks.
I must admit, I'm less convinced that investors are full of SSA bonds and that's why they're not buying more, because
right,
it's a surprise to no one that September is busy. You know, right, it's just a standard indeed thing that happens every year.
Yes.
So the idea that this has somehow taken investors by surprise, or that banks or the investment teams at these places who are in constant conversation with investors, you know, they know what investors are doing and what they're thinking, and you know, it's it just feels a bit of a stretch to think that they didn't appreciate that investors couldn't.
I mean, I'm absolutely inclined to agree. The other point is, of course, that all of these issuers reveal what their funding plans are going to be at the start of the year. They generally stick to them. They generally don't change that much, really. So, and of course, these are the best rated issuers. So it's very easy to get, or should be very easy to get, credit line approval for whatever it is they want to do.
I can see how it's much more of a head scratcher in the SSA market if deals don't go well than in other markets, because you can draw such a straight line usually between curves and, you know, how much things should cost, because they do so many bonds and so on. And there's so many comparables that are fresh bonds that are highly traded. So, you know where the market's pricing these things. So as you say, for Council of Europe Development Bank to come with a deal that didn't do well at what should have been a blowout price, because, you know, like, you can see where all the data tells you that a blowout price would be. I can see why that's caused so much confusion and frustration, I guess.
Well, there is a third theory.
Oh, yeah.
And it's something we alluded to last week, and that is that everyone's waiting for the European Union to bring its first syndication of the autumn. Now, why is that important? Well, the EU, as we've discussed many times, is an absolute whopping borrower, even for this market. In the first half of the year alone, it raised 80 billion euros worth of bonds. That's as big as many of the biggest supranationals and agencies do all year in the syndicated market. And it's doing its first syndication next week. So people are sort of suggesting that maybe some investors have withheld from investing in the market because they want to buy the EU's deal. Now, the reason they will do that is because obviously they're the biggest, most liquid issuer out there now. And also because they have such a big program, they tend to pay up a little bit more than some SSA issuers to get their bonds done. So once again, it looks like the SSA market is all sort of looking to the EU to provide some sort of direction.
So really, it would almost be more helpful if the EU came at the start of issuance windows and really sort of set the tone, rather than,
yeah,
because next week is, you know, we've got the European Central Bank next week, we've got a bunch of US data prints next week. It would make, yeah, be more helpful and more constructive, I guess, because the EU is going to want these other SSAs to do well in the market, because ultimately they're going to be partially responsible for them, right?
Yes, exactly. It's all public money, a lot of them all part of the euro public sector,
you know, exactly. So it would make much more sense for the EU to be first. And in many markets, that's what you see. You see the strongest issuer come first, and then the, you know, that sets the tone. So I wonder why they've chosen to come so late in the day.
Well, they set their issuance calendar out very rigidly because they have to do so much. They figured it was better to give everyone certainty over when it would come to the market. And then, as you've seen over the last couple of years, everyone then dances around the EU. Now, that works probably pretty well for the biggest borrowers like EIB and the World Bank and KfW usually. And, you know, the evidence was there this week in the EIB's latest benchmark deal. But it, I guess it can make things a bit trickier for others. There is a bit of an irony here, though, which is that in June, the EU said for the second half of the year, it would only, quote unquote, be, well, I'm not quoting them, but you get my point, be raising 40 billion euros. That was about half what many people had expected. So you might think, well, all of a sudden, OK, well, there's more money to go around the SSA sector, and that should benefit other issuers. But it didn't really work out like that, because when the EU did its first syndication for the second half of the year, it ended up getting a record order book, because now all of a sudden there's a perception of scarcity, would you believe it, around EU bonds.
So and everyone's tossing in these bigger tickets to try and get a bigger allocation.
Exactly. Everyone wants to go for those bonds. You know, the EU typically starts with a 4 basis point new issue premium rather than, say, 2 basis points. It usually ends up paying 2 basis points, but it, you know, it starts a little bit wider. So I guess, you know, everyone's waiting to see what the EU is going to do next week. And they hope that will sort of finally settle SSA investors down and they can get on with the rest of the autumn.
We'll go to Turkey and its banks in a short while. But first, let's move to something which is decidedly and famously not EU, and that's the UK and its local governments, and Birmingham, which is hitting very high financial troubles.
John, it feels strange to welcome you to the podcast, seeing as you're the co-host, but you're off duties this week. So welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much.
There's been a lot of frenzied news this week in the UK about Birmingham. Now, probably most of our international listeners will know Birmingham, which is the UK's second city, through the TV show Peaky Blinders, in which Brummies attack each other with razor blades in their hats. But it's not just TV gangsters that are slashing away at the moment, is it, in Birmingham? Because it's the city council and its budget and its spending and a spot of bother.
Yes, it's a big shock. Birmingham, obviously, is one of the most prestigious local authorities in the UK, being, you know, its biggest city with a sole local authority, since London has it's divided into multiple boroughs. And for a financial problem of this scale to hit Birmingham is a shock. The council have said they have discovered a liability of some 650 million to 760 million pounds. And this has come up from left field. It's left over, in fact, from a 2012 court judgment against Birmingham for having paid women unequally. The council already thought it had dealt with the many hundreds of millions of that liability, but this, it turns out, they've undercalculated it.
Right. Okay. I mean, this is just the sort of latest story of misery in UK local government finance, isn't it? Because there's been a sort of I guess a growing number of cases, not all the same causes by any means, but where local councils have found themselves in bother over recent years.
Yes, there've been a number of stories. Croydon is a well-known one, the South London borough, where they invested in local commercial property and in a way that lost them money. Thurrock Council to the east of London have invested in a range of solar parks that were similar lack of success. And the big one, well, it's a small town, but it's a massive problem, is Woking to the west of London, where they've invested in skyscraper developments in the centre of town and been hit by the savage fall in property prices recently.
I mean, that really does sound like the sort of classic small town with ambitions above its status sort of hubristic problem. But I'm sure the Woking Council leaders had their reasons for doing what they did. Now, just how much peril is Birmingham in? You know, some of the reporting that we've read this week has been quite sort of sensational. Is Birmingham about to default on its debts? What's going to happen?
Well, no, probably not. The local authorities in the UK are a peculiar sector. They have a sort of mother lender, which is the Public Works Loans Board, which is a sort of department of the Treasury. It's very little known outside financial circles, but this doles out a vast amount of money in debt to local councils. And the thing is that because it's act as their lender of last resort, it's unlikely that Birmingham will default in the way it would if it had unsustainable loans to a commercial lender. So the government can sort of keep Birmingham hanging on and keep it making payments on any debt it has. But what it will have to do is drastically cut public services and any other projects it was about to engage in. It's issued something called a Section 114 notice, and that means that basically the council is in dire straits. The government has to oversee it carefully, and basically all non-essential spending is cancelled.
What sort of wriggle room does Birmingham have to generate more revenue?
Well, this is one of the difficulties. The councils in the UK, unlike, for example, those in the US, have very little power to raise taxes locally. And any American listeners will be surprised by this, but they, although they're locally elected and responsible to the local community, they're strictly limited by the government in how much they can raise taxes, which is between 2-5% a year, depending on the purpose. So they can't tax their way out of the problem. Councils have access to some other revenues like parking fines and things, but those are limited. The best thing is if they have physical assets they can sell, but that is often not the case. And I think the huge size of this problem at Birmingham means it's going to take a long time to solve or require the central government to bail them out.
Now, John, in your story that you've written about this, which is incredibly interesting, the Public Works Loans Board accounts for 80% of local authority borrowing or funding. 20% there is therefore from other sources. Let's just ask quickly about that 80%, because the PWLB is, of course, part of the UK Debt Management Office. Now, does this will this sort of ripple through to the gilt market, do we think, in any way?
No, I don't think so. The gilt market's enormous, and gilt investors aren't going to be too worried about a financial problem in Birmingham. I suppose if it swept across the sector, as some fear it could, that could hit headlines further afield and sort of diminish the UK's perception slightly in capital markets. But that isn't happening at the moment.
Okay. And then of that 20%, how much of that debt, or do we have any examples of that debt in the capital markets themselves? Because some UK authorities have done private placements and so on, haven't they?
Yeah, and some have done public bonds. But it's very rare. Traditionally, the local authorities in the UK don't use the capital markets in the same way that those in France or Italy or Germany often do. One of the reasons is historic, that in the 1980s, there was a terrible scandal with Hammersmith and Fulham Council where they blew themselves up with derivatives. And that sort of has caused the central government to be very strict about them using financial products. But in the last decade or so, there have been efforts to sort of relax that and get them using commercial capital markets more, which has led to bond issues, for example, by Lancashire County Council and private placements by councils, including Glasgow. But these are isolated deals. I think the interesting thing about what's going on now for the capital markets is that this is a whole new rash of risks that people weren't talking about when they were enthusiastically trying to do bond and private placement deals for councils a few years ago.
Were you able to speak to any investors in UK local authority debt to see what they think?
Yeah, me and my colleague Mike Turner spoke to two, both of whom are in the private placement market. And they, you know, one was a little blasé about it, thinking that it was likely the government would bail Birmingham out. But he didn't have exposure to it. And, you know, he might have been being a bit cavalier because of that. But the other one, you know, was more along the lines of "I told you so." Mm. He'd been offered a number of private placements for UK councils a few years ago and had turned them all down quite quickly on the grounds that he thought they were much riskier than they were being presented as. These were offered really as single A type credits, even if they didn't have explicit credit ratings. And bearing in mind that the UK's rating for Moody's is only AA3, and some of the councils, in fact, are rated AA3 by Moody's, so very close to the sovereign rating. And he said, "Well, this didn't stack up. They were overlevered. They had little control over their actual financial futures because of this inability to raise taxes. Their cost bases were fairly vulnerable to things like inflation, as has panned out. And you know, he didn't see them as strong credits."
Well, you mentioned, speaking of sort of, I guess, credit enhancements and so on, you mentioned France and Germany. Now, aficionados of the sovereign, supranational and agency bond market, such as ourselves, are familiar with agencies like Communinvest, Communalbank and Amunifin in the Nordic countries, and Esfil in France, and the Joint Lander in Germany. Now, these are all institutions that borrow on behalf of a group of local authorities. So they obviously pull their resources together. They can go to the wholesale capital markets for big syndicated benchmarks any number of times a year, and then they lend that on to local authorities. Do you get a sense that this is something that perhaps the UK might want to look into in future for its local authorities? Because I guess the problem has always been that there is no cheaper funding than for the UK than through the gilt market, which is effectively how this is done at the moment. And also there is a UK municipal bond agency, isn't there?
Well, there's something called the UK Municipal Bond Agency, but it's not an official government agency. It's a venture that was set up really after some ideas thrown around by the local government association. And it's managed to issue two bonds of substantial size, both for Lancashire County Council. Effectively, the UK MBA acts as a sort of vehicle or facilitator for Lancashire to issue bonds. So it's nothing really like the agencies that exist in nearly every European country to do, you know, serious capital markets financing on a large scale for local authorities.
Should we have one then?
It's an interesting idea, and I think it would be a major reform. Mm. And the UK is not sort of particularly fleet-footed about major reforms and creating new institutions. But I think it has much to recommend it. If you think about the high profile and, you know, AAA ratings and strong bond market following of entities like BNG in the Netherlands and the others you mentioned, they could raise financing effectively. And the fact that they have to be out there in the bond market and have credit ratings means they have to apply certain standards of transparency. They get thoroughly looked over by the rating agencies and investors. So there's a whole sort of professionalization of the funding of the sector. And that hasn't really happened with the Public Works Loans Board, which doesn't fund in its own name. It's just a channel for basically dishing out gilt proceeds to the local authorities. And it hasn't really exercised careful oversight of them. A lot of the loans made for these very risky investments, such as at Woking, were from the PWLB. And, you know, an entity like BNG would not make that mistake simply because it can't afford to. So I think there's a good case for a thoroughgoing reform of local government in the UK, but that is a massive political project that's going to take years and be very controversial.
Yeah, I mean, I do wonder if the discipline of having to rely on the capital markets would stop some of the more esoteric, shall we say, investments that some local authorities have made. But equally, I do wonder if it's even possible, because as you mentioned earlier, local councils in the UK don't have an awful lot of flexibility to change their revenue. They can only cut spending. Who would eventually guarantee or, you know, back this this sort of local financing agency? Presumably the councils themselves. And if they can't raise revenue to service it, then it's a problem.
Well, it's because of the peculiar constraints on the sector that I think a specialist agency might be the answer, because realistically, these are not good credits for capital markets investors to distinguish between. Birmingham would have been seen as one of the best in the country, and look what's happened to them. Now, you know, there are investors in debt of councils like Durham and Westminster that no doubt feel that they've, you know, made good decisions and chosen good councils. But, you know, the capital markets discipline you're referring to, I don't think can realistically operate on a deal by deal basis because of the complexity of the sector and the difficulty of analysing it from afar. So I think a specialist agency, though, that thoroughly understood, you know, the loans it was making might be in a position to do that. And then, you know, the risks would be pooled. Provided it was capitalised by the government, it, you know, should be able to absorb losses if they occurred. And it would be quite easy for the government to rescue it if should the unthinkable happen and, you know, its capital get seriously impaired.
And I suppose it would have that maybe slight perk of if more and more local authority funding was done through a separate agency, of reducing the UK's sovereign borrowing requirement and perhaps even pushing down gilt costs. Is it after all a trick that plenty of other European sovereigns use to sort of split their borrowing up amongst different entities?
Well, yes, optically it would. I don't know whether in the way government accounts are done, they really count as off balance sheet, but certainly it would from the capital markets optics point of view, it would shift it into a different box.
Hello, George. Welcome back to the podcast.
Morning, Ralph. Thanks very much for having me.
Now, to return to one of the topics we cover a fair bit on this podcast, which I find permanently fascinating, and that's Turkey in the capital markets. And that's a country with huge economic problems. It's got the sort of inflation that makes that in the UK, US and Europe look utterly limp by comparison. They've also just re-elected the president that many people think has caused the problem, or at least exacerbated it. And they're also now recovering from a devastating earthquake. Now, if you add to that the problem of capital markets access for emerging market borrowers in general, thanks to rising interest rates, particularly in dollars. And it feels sometimes like we're just sort of sitting around waiting for Turkish bond issuers to suffer some sort of terrible calamity in the market. But it never really happens. Certainly every time Turkish issuers come to the market, it's a noteworthy event, though. And there were two deals this week. So tell us a bit about what happened.
Yeah, so there were two Turkish banks that issued bonds this week, Vakıf Bank and Yapı Kredi. And they were the first Turkish banks to issue bonds since January. And in Yapı Kredi's case, it was the first private bank to issue a bond since 2021. So it's been a very long time. And they were both identical formats, five-year sustainable bonds, and both had to offer coupons of over 9%, or 9% in Vakıf Bank's case, 9.25% for Yapı Kredi. And demand was pretty good. Vakıf Bank got a 2.5 billion peak order book nearly, and managed to increase the size for what it originally planned. And Yapı Kredi's was 2x oversubscribed as well.
Okay, that's great. But your story sort of suggested that Yapı Kredi's deal was not perceived in quite such a glowing light as Vakıf Bank's.
Yeah, I think the general consensus is that it did not go as well as it might have. And the main point of criticism was that Yapı Kredi announced its mandate on Tuesday afternoon, which is before Vakif Bank had actually priced and allocated its own deal. Vakif Bank went to the market on Tuesday. And normally you see, at least in emerging markets, issuers will announce their trades in the morning or by lunchtime at the very latest, either for execution on that day or following days. So it was unusual. And one banker on the Yapı Kredi deal said he'd never announced a mandate so late in his whole career. And it skewed both trades, I think. It affected Vakif Bank's trading on secondary markets on Wednesday, the day after it priced. And it also potentially damaged demand for Yapı Kredi's deal itself. I think the bankers I spoke to that worked on Yapı Kredi said they would rather have waited a little bit more time, sort of for the dust to settle, as it were, after Vakif Bank's deal before another Turkish bank came. So there was some understanding as to why Yapı Kredi did it. One of the syndicates who worked on it said that they wanted to secure the next slot, as it were, for Turkish bank insurance, because there are more plans to come. But it did seem to mean that Yapı Kredi's deal especially did not go quite as well as it should have.
I mean, was Yapı Kredi's performance in the primary market just down to the timing of messaging, do you think? Or was the market markedly different on Wednesday to Tuesday? Because that can also sometimes have an effect.
Yeah, that did have an effect. There was some sympathy for Yapı Kredi as well, in that Wednesday was a bit of a weaker day for markets in general. Investors were a little bit more nervous than they might have been on Tuesday, said one fund manager we spoke to. So it wasn't just, you know, the timing. There was a weaker day than Tuesday, so you have to take that into account.
I guess the fact that these weaker days can happen and do happen is why you should plan your timing a bit better, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
There's no need to shoot yourself in the foot by making it more difficult than you have to.
Yeah, I mean, they announce late on Tuesday and you don't know what the market's going to be like on Wednesday morning, and once you've announced, you don't have to go, but it would look very unusual to announce and then not go. It wouldn't look very organized. So yeah, that's another point as to why maybe, you know, they could have waited a day or two just to see how the dust had settled.
And of course, there were no other Turkish bank bond mandates after Yapı Kredi, were there this week?
Nope, there weren't. There are more out there. That's something syndicate bankers have said. But no, there were none on Wednesday, and there were none on Thursday either, or today on Friday.
Yeah. I mean, perhaps they were put off by how Yapı Kredi went. I don't know. But I suppose you know, Yapı Kredi did at least get its funding done. And of course, the big question for Turkey in the bond markets is always whether the sovereign has access to the markets. Now, it has a reputation as a very savvy bond issuer. How much does it have to raise for the rest of the year? And do this week's deals from the two banks tell us anything about investors' appetite for Turkey risk more generally?
On the second point, not entirely, because they are just very different issuers. Speaking to fund managers and investors, speaking to fund managers and bankers earlier this week, asking them whether the success or lack of success from Turkish bank deals would have any effect on how the sovereign would be able to sell bonds, it's not really was the answer. It's sort of a different beast, as it were. Investor demand is pretty good, I think. Foreign investors are very underweight Turkey. They have been for quite a long time because of the economic and monetary policy mismanagement over the past couple of years. So there will be a strong technical demand for any bonds they issue. But also, investors are happy with what the authorities have been doing in the past couple of months since the election in May. They've sort of U-turned on the unorthodox policies they'd been pressing for quite some time. So the sovereign has $2.5 billion left to do. So I think their funding target was $10 billion this year.
$2.5 billion, is it?
Dollars, yeah. So they've done $10 billion so far this year in three different transactions, including a green debut. And so they have two and a half left to do, and they will do that at some point. And actually, one investor said he was shocked that they didn't do so this week, although they have just released a medium-term economic plan. So I think that may have delayed things, but right. I would not be surprised to see them next week, for example.
And of course, Turkey has a range of markets. The sovereign anyway has a range of markets in which it can do the funding. It doesn't just have to come to the Eurobond market, for example, does it?
No, it can tap the Sukuk market, which it did twice last year. It was the first time it had ever printed more than one Sukuk in a year. Sukuk is an Islamic bond, and it hasn't done so this year, so that's definitely an option. And Sukuk issuers across all sorts of markets, whether it's real estate companies in the Gulf region or sovereigns in that part of the world, they've all done pretty spectacularly. So it does have that option. Yeah, it's not just limited to conventional issuance.
And do you think Turkey will take some encouragement from Hungary, which is also a country with its own, very different, but its own sort of, I guess, financing, or how can I put this, road bumps, shall we say. But it did a deal this week, didn't it?
Yeah, investors have had sort of long-running concerns in Hungary about its spat with the EU over the primacy of the rule of law and corruption and things like that, which have led to nearly 30 billion euros of funding being withheld, which is pretty significant. And it's a quite a hole in Hungary's budget, which it can't fund entirely on the Eurobond market, but it has affected its Eurobond financing needs. It has had to increase it. And it did so earlier this week, just before it issued the Eurobond. So yeah, Hungary, it went fine. It's a triple B credit, so it's a few notches higher than Turkey. But it's by no means one of the safest Central and Eastern European sovereigns out there. So the fact that went pretty well should bode well for an issuer like Turkey.
So you mentioned that you wouldn't be surprised to see the Turkish sovereign next week. Will it be competing against much in terms of other deals?
There is a pipeline out there across CEMEA. In Central and Eastern Europe, there are one or two other sovereigns looking to issue new bonds, including from the Balkan region. There are more banks. So there was a Polish bank that mandated a debut on Wednesday, Millennium Bank. And there are a couple of other CE banks as well looking from other parts of that part of the world. So there is pipeline from there. The Middle East as well, there's the usual list of issuers that we've had. It's been one of the hotspots for issuance over the past year or two. The pipeline's not super heavy, though. It will be a sort of steady supply rather than a big rush. There's still very little to come from Africa, and that which is going to come is probably not going to be for a couple of weeks at least. So yeah, if Turkey did decide to come, it might have a tiny bit of traffic, but it would be nothing to worry about, I don't think.
Well, to follow all that's going on in Turkey capital markets, for the best, sharpest analysis of UK local authority financing, and of course, all developments in the corporate and SSA bond markets, there's no better thing to do than read globalcapital.com, or of course, to subscribe to this podcast, which is out every Friday. It only remains for me to thank Mike, John, and George for joining me to record this edition, and to thank you most of all for listening. We'll be back with more from the capital markets next week. So thank you once again, and goodbye. We'll be right back.